The federal government that we know and often complain about today was very different a century and a half ago. For a very long time, most of the non-military employees of the federal government worked for the post office. The post office was there before independence, there for westward expansion, there through several wars. Winifred Gallagher's book on the agency and its importance is called How the Post Office Created America, A History. Winifred Gallagher, the author, writes a lot. Her work appears in the likes of The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times. And she is the author of 8 other books, including It's in the Bag, A Study of Purses, and New, Understanding Our Need for Novelty and Change. Winifred Gallagher, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So after a book like New, how'd you end up on a subject so old?
It rose from a personal experience. I live in New York City. And about 10 years ago, my husband and I fell in love with the northwest corner of Wyoming. And I started driving across the country. And like everybody who's had that experience, I was immediately struck on a gut level with how huge America is, how varied it is in terrain and culture, how much of it is still rural. And I began to think about what was it that actually strung the East and West Coast together and all the huge area in between. And it kind of dawned on me like an epiphany, really, it was our communications and information network, which, of course, is our post office.
As you put it, nothing less than the story of America. That's pretty high praise, but as you point out, this is really the story. I mean, the post office, the country wouldn't be what it was like today, what it is like today, if it weren't for the post office being there along the way.
For a very long time, some would argue up until around World War I, the post office was the federal government's biggest, most important function. And as far as most Americans, it was the federal government. The only federal employee most Americans ever would see in their life was the postmaster. So it was a hugely important organization. Politically, it was tremendously important. Back in 1792, the founders already anticipated my experience of driving across the country. They said, what in the world was going to hold all the people in all these different states and territories? What was going to hold them together? And how was a government by, for, and of the people going to function as a democracy unless the people knew what was going on? They needed, in other words, to have an informed electorate. And they decided to organize our postal system around newspapers so that citizens everywhere would have access to uncensored news and opinions and be able to talk among themselves and come up with informed political views. This was an extraordinarily radical thing at the time. It horrified the European powers that had no interest whatever in letting average people know what the government was up to. And it really poised us to become the global information and communication superpower that we are today. In fact, when Alexis de Tocqueville came in 1831, he was astounded that he could go into the Michigan outbacks in his stage mail coach trip and find pioneers emerging from their log cabins talking about current events not only in America but in Europe. At that point, even though we were still wet behind the ears as a country, we already had 5 times more post offices than France and twice as many as Great Britain, these old, well-established countries. So it really was an extraordinary an accomplishment for a young country to pull off.
All right, so a couple of pathways to understand here. You mentioned the newspapers, and you know, most of us who do still get paper newspapers get them delivered by somebody who is working as a carrier for the paper. Different situation back then, though, it sounds like. So the newspapers were sent through the post.
Yeah, the only way to transfer information back then was the mail. The mail was the media. That's what they had to work with. And the founders actually came up with this very ingenious kind of Robin Hood scheme where they paid for this very ambitious circulation of newspapers with postage on letters. Letters, most Americans didn't even get one letter a year until the mid-19th century when there were cheap postage reforms and you could send a letter for 3 cents. Until that point, both here and in Europe. Most mail, most letter mail was sent by businessmen, public officials who had the franking privilege so they could use the mail for free, very, very wealthy people. So it was really a very ingenious way to enable the dissemination of news.
How different then was our early postal system from say what it existed under English rule?
Well, the system that started in 1792, that's when our postal system actually became distinctively American. Remember that Benjamin Franklin, our first postmaster general, had run the North Atlantic colonial postal system for Great Britain for years before the American Revolution. So Franklin's post was pretty much like the British post. It was based on the European model, which was connecting basically big cities that had businessmen who could pay money to make money for the crown, concentrating the postal system here along the East Coast where the cities were and the businessmen were. He was certainly a competent postmaster, but he was not he was not the fellow who envisioned this very radical newspaper-oriented post. The post office was more important to Franklin. His experience running the colonial post gave him this vision of how these 13 very fractious, very argumentative colonies that were not good neighbors, how they actually could be strung together into a larger union. It affected his political thinking. That was what was much more important than what he actually did as Postmaster General.
Communication is certainly the key and one of the rationales for the early post office. And the book is called How the Post Office Created America. Winifred Gallagher is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk with her and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Winifred Gallagher, the author of several books. Her latest is How the Post Office Created America. It gives a strong rationale for how the postal system that we got started very early on back in the 18th century really led to the creation of the country that we've come to know today. Regardless of how we feel about the postal system now, the fact is it was instrumental for a very, very long time as the media that connected us in the days before telegraph even. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions, your comments, your observations about the history of the Postal Service. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to understand again, the European system generally was a postal system to connect business people and elites with the crown, it sounds like. And we're talking about a system for the common people in America.
Yes, exactly. It was as radical an idea as the revolution itself. It was the people in the United States. The people were sovereign, not the sovereign. So it really underscored that idea that the average person was very important and was allowed to know all the workings of the government and have a say in those workings through the vote. It was an extraordinary position at the time.
So post and publishing really went hand in hand from the sounds of it. So, I mean, this is something that Benjamin Franklin could certainly use with the things that he published. But then Thomas Paine, I'm guessing, and a lot of other people who wrote things for mass consumption were able to get it consumed on a mass basis because of the postal system that existed.
It really was an enormous boost to many different functions of the economy. You've identified publishing as one of them for sure. As soon as the post office said, we're going to deliver your newspapers for a penny or a penny and a half, any Tom, Dick, or Harry who had an idea of, like, had 50 bucks and could set up a printing press was in the publishing business. It was a huge, it unleashed a huge burst of newspapers And by the time of the, let's say, the towards the middle of the 19th century, after the Civil War, certainly, it was a huge stimulus to the advertising industry, because now advertisers had a way to circulate information about products through these very cheaply circulated newspapers and periodicals. It also was an enormous stimulus to the consumer culture. Parcel post, which was passed around in the early part of the 20th century, allowed rural Americans, and that was still 60% of the population, to order inexpensive consumer goods from Montgomery Ward in this year's Roebuck catalog and get them delivered for a fair price. Previous to that, they were pretty much stuck with paying whatever the local general store wanted to charge, which was a lot. And the private carriers, American Express and Wells Fargo, had a monopoly on delivering any goods that Americans wanted to order by mail. Well, not by mail, but by private delivery services. So that if you did want to get something sent to your home, you had to pay an exorbitant price to one of these private carriers. So parcel post put an end to American Express and Wells Fargo out of the express freight business, which had been their strong suit, and that's why they concentrate even today on financial services, because parcel post put them out of the freighting business. It's very interesting.
I'm just realizing as we talk about American Express and Wells Fargo that we're talking about entities that people know of today but don't know as express agencies. And of course, a lot of us grew up knowing REA, the Railway Express Agency, which was still doing television ads well into the 60s, but pretty much collapsed with passenger trains pre-Amtrak.
Yeah, you can't really talk about the postal system without talking about the transportation industry. It's really fascinating. The post really subsidized our transportation grid. Bear in mind, in the early days, America was pretty much a wilderness. There weren't even roads outside of cities, and maybe a narrow band along the East Coast. There weren't even roads that could accommodate a wagon with wheels. People had to either walk or ride a horse. The post subsidized the post riders, those guys on the horse, and then really by the late part of the 18th century was subsidizing the incredibly important stagecoach industry, which people don't realize that in the East as well as the West, stagecoaches ruled the roads. They were incredibly important, not only as mail coaches, but also as transportation of passengers. So the post was subsidizing, propping up that whole industry, allowing the stagecoach proprietors to add services and expand. So they were not just subsidizing Americans' newspapers, but also their ability to travel, and they did. Americans were, even though the traveling conditions were hard, they traveled a lot more than we like to think, or we often think.
Winifred Gallagher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called How the Post Office Created America. And so let's get an idea of scale here. As of 1790, there were 75 post offices. That was it for the original 13 states. When was the greatest expansion, Winifred, and how was it funded?
It started expanding just hand over fist right away. It kept up with the nation really was pushing westward even before Washington became president. Ohio was the Wild West. And as soon as Americans pushed west, they could petition their representatives for postal service. Postal service was not an absolute right like freedom of speech or freedom of religion, but it was considered a legitimate claim that citizens could make on the government, and it was very often they were very often granted their request for a post office. So as soon as you had a group of people who called for a post office and they got it, then mail would be delivered, and the whole dynamic of the roads and the post offices would kick in, and it just crept right across the country as fast as Americans did.
So the post offices had to get out there. Transportation networks had to spring up to get to the post offices, and that really led to the concurrent rise of transportation.
That's right.
So Benjamin Rush, in addition to Benjamin Franklin, gets a fair amount of ink in the book. You call him a lousy doctor, but it sounds like he did good things for the post office.
Yeah, he was he's most famous. It's a shame. He's misunderstood these days, I think. He's most famous for being the Surgeon General of the Revolutionary Army. He was actually resigned from that position, was almost fired from that position. He had very strong political views about various things. And he was a famous doctor, but his main cure for everything was basically laxatives. So he was not, certainly by our standards, he was not a great doctor at a time when medicine was not very highly developed. But he was a wonderful political philosopher. He himself came from a relatively simple background. His father died when he was very young, and in order that he could have some kind of a education, his mother sent him off to an uncle who was a clergyman who could afford to educate Benjamin, who, of course, was rapidly revealed as a prodigy. He went on to have a wonderful education, and he knew the importance of education in his own life, and he felt very strongly that the government had to educate the people. He thought the federal government should pay for public education from primary school all the way through college, and he saw the post office as a means of ensuring and developing American literacy, because what good was a newspaper if you couldn't read it? So he was a very eloquent spokesman for the rights of average people to be educated and informed.
How big a political football, then, I wonder, did the post office become between the Federalists and the people who wanted a weaker federal government?
Well, Alexander Hamilton was not, he's popular now, especially here in New York City, on Broadway.
Right.
He believed, like Franklin, he believed that the post office should be a money-making enterprise for the government, and it should be kept concentrated in big cities where businessmen would pay a lot for letters. So they had to come up with a way, how are they going to fund this very ambitious system? And the way that they came about it was this Robin Hood scheme, where they would use the expensive postage for letter mail to pay for the cheap circulation of newspapers for everybody.
Winifred Gallagher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called How the Post Office Created America, A History. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the post office and how instrumental it was in creating the country we have today. You've got some issues with the post office. We could hear those as well. 800-838-3760 for your questions, comments, and observations. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to George in Wairika. Welcome to the Exchange.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I certainly appreciate it, and a fascinating subject that's indicative of what's going on in our country right now. Can she explain, express an opinion on the poison pill that's been handed to the post office and the attempts to privatize it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. All right. Thanks for that, George. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I think George is referring to the a law passed in 2006 that imposed this terrible burden on the post office, where they were required, unlike any other public or private institution, to come up with to pay the Treasury $5 billion a year for 10 years to pre-fund its retiree health care benefits. This amounted to, it's often, the formulation is often that to pre-fund these benefits for 75 years forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just a terrible burden to impose on the organization, and that really accounts for when we hear about these terrible deficits that make it seem like the post office is on the verge of extinction. The lion's share of that deficit comes from that terrible imposition. The larger issue really is that the post office made a terrible mistake by not going digital in the 1980s. There were visionary people in the post office who saw that email was the logical extension of letter mail, paper mail. There were even people in Congress who saw it, the writing on the wall, and urged them to do it. But they were so they just chickened out. It was a big step. It would have been enormous capital expense, similar to, say, rural electrification or the National Highway Project, and they just decide they made the wrong decision and they didn't take that step, which is really too bad. And the other unfortunate thing that the post office is really suffering from, when it was made, when the post office department, which was a regular department of the federal government like state or treasury, in 1970 was turned into the United States Postal Service, which is what we call it now, the USPS, it was told that it had to run like a business, except it had to accept these, in other words, be self-supporting, except it had to accept these constraints that no business would accept, principally congressional oversight, so the Congress can meddle in its affairs for political reasons all the time. And it also had to keep its fixed low prices regardless of its cost. So I can send a birthday card to my friend down the street for the same price that I can send a birthday card to a friend in Alaska, even though it costs the post office a whole lot more to get that card to Alaska. So no business would accept, you know, these kinds of constraints. And so the post office is really kind of in a straitjacket that only Congress can untangle. And I'm hopeful right now is actually a moment that there could be a serious postal reform act to ameliorate some of the terrible mistakes that were made in the Act of 2006, because the Senate has passed a postal reform bill, and now, very recently, the House has passed one, too. So if they could get together and come up with a way that the Post was allowed to modernize its business model and update itself for the 21st century, I think it would be a wonderful thing.
Pensions aside, Winifred, what has been the general, I mean, has it changed over time, that the way Congress felt about the postal system generally, that whether it should or should not be bringing in money to cover its own costs, or whether it could come from the general fund?
Well, it's the problem with privatization, to me, it's really, it's almost like a fantasy. It makes for, there are people who don't like any government at all, would like to, like, shrink the government down to nothing, or just, you know, maybe eliminate it entirely. And, of course, they also don't like the post office. They think it should be privatized. But this makes for kind of exciting letters to the editor and newspapers and so forth and so on. But it's not widely popular. Most Americans do not see why they should choose between paper mail and email. They like the post office. The post office receives no tax dollars whatsoever. And another thing that the privatizers really skip over is the way our national delivery system actually operates. The UPS, FedEx, and the Post are they're not competitors. The word that's often used now is co-competitors. They cooperate, at least as kind of frenemies, in delivering Americans' mail and goods, in that, for example, the post office often delivers the so-called last mile for FedEx and UPS. That means the post office, which visits every address in America almost every day, has to go to those addresses. And the two private companies don't have the resources to do that. They couldn't possibly do it. So in many cases, it's the post office that does that last bit of delivery for the private companies, who pay the post office to do that. In the same light, the post office, the government, pays FedEx to fly the U.S. mail on its planes. FedEx flies its own mail at night and U.S. mail by day. So privatization, I think, is more of a, it's kind of like a catchy thing to talk about. I don't think it's ever going to happen. The other alternative, at the complete other end of the scale, is there are people who would like to see the term postal service retrofitted for the digital age. They would like us all to have electronic addresses, postal addresses, the same way we have physical postal addresses. They'd like us to have all kinds of electronic services, verification and authentication for legal and business transactions, postal banking. You hear people want to bring back the postal banking system. They'd like to see post offices turned into community information centers, which they used to be. I personally can't understand why every post office in America doesn't have a bank of computers. So so that people can have access to the internet and go online. Every library in America has computers, and people wait to take numbers to get a chance to go online. But for some reason, our post offices are not allowed to offer those services. So that's, in other words, the privatizers are at one end of the spectrum. At the other end are the people who would like to expand postal service. But I think what's the likeliest outcome, that the postal service will continue to be our national hard copy delivery system. Profitable services will be emphasized and unprofitable ones will be downsized or eliminated. And one bright light, postal people like to say, the internet giveth and it taketh away. Well, one thing that it giveth is parcel delivery. The post office volume of parcel delivery rose by 50% just between 2010 and 2015. And the revenue that the post office is now getting from parcels is enough to compensate for what it's losing to email from first-class mail.
Wow, that's a lot of parcels getting moved around. The book is called How the Post Office Created America. Winifred Gallagher is its author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her. We got a phone call. Well, we had a phone call and an email waiting. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Winifred and take some input from you when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Winifred Gallagher, the author of several books. Her latest is called How the Post Office Created America, A History. She makes a strong case for getting all those post offices onto the American frontier. Required things like roads and canals and railroads to get to them so we can to get our communication system and our transportation system through history via the post office. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your observations, questions, comments are welcome at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about technology and the post office. It seems like the post office has taken passes a couple times in history. You talk about telegraph in here, and there was an opportunity, it sounds like, in the early days of telegraph for the post office to make that part of its system?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story in itself that went spanned actually two centuries. Samuel Morse wanted his invention, the electric telegraph to be part of the post, and the post office did run it for a while. But something that happens really like a pendulum action throughout American history. Sometimes the country leans in the direction of thinking the government is the best way to get things done for the people, and then back to the extreme of like, no, business is the best way to get things done. So around the middle of the 19th century, even though there had been a lot of enthusiasm to have a postal telegraph, it was said, as we hear these days, don't let the government do it. The government won't do a good job. Let business do it. And it ended up being privatized, essentially. The issue didn't die, though. President U.S. Grant was among many prominent Americans after that decision was made to protest it and to think that the government really should be running the postal telegraph. But in the end, business won out. Interestingly, the telegraph, the importance of the telegraph for average Americans was not that great. Again, it was good for media, it was good for the newspapers to get newspaper reports. It was good for businessmen, Wall Street types, they could get market information. But what it was really swamped by the explosion of letter mail around the same time. The peak of the post office really started in the mid 19th century when Congress realized that, well, the people were furious at the high rates of postage, and they cut postal rates back first to 5 cents and 10 cents, and then shortly thereafter to 3 cents. And Americans just went crazy writing letters. It was a phenomenal explosion of mail volume. People could communicate about personal matters that much more freely. It changed people's relationships. It changed relationships over distance. And all of that really came to a peak during the Progressive Era between 1890 up to, like, let's say, World War One. At the same time that the railroads that were carrying a lot of the mail peaked, with a huge explosion of postal services, enormous advance for rural Americans was rural free delivery. So now, for the first time, country folks had their mail delivered to their homes and farms the same way people in the cities had starting back in the Civil War era. They also got parcel post, which was a phenomenal development that meant that they could order inexpensive goods from the Sears catalog, the Montgomery Ward catalog, and have them delivered to their farms and homes very inexpensively by the post office rather than paying outrageous prices to American Express and Wells Fargo to do it. And even postal savings banking. People who, low-income people, especially in small town and rural areas, who were ignored by the big banking industry because they couldn't make any money from these folks, could now go to their post office and bank their money safely and make a small, rate of interest on it. So there was an enormous explosion of what, a redefinition really of what postal service meant. It was no longer just mail. It was basically the big, shaggy, baggy, lovable federal enterprise that was good to the people.
The idea of private mail, though, as you point out when you talk about the Post Office Act of 1792, I mean, it was not something that, I mean, people didn't expect to be able to write a letter and take it to a government facility and have it delivered, it sounds like.
No, not here and not in Europe. It was postal systems, like information about government affairs, were very restricted to an elite. There was not that expectation. Most people, a lot of news was circulated by word of mouth. People talked about what was going on. They went to their post offices and picked up their newspapers and talked about the news. The postmaster would often have a peek at what was in the mailbag and talk about, gee, I see I have a letter from so-and-so, and I wonder what's going on with him. And then if that person came in, he was expected to read his letter to the other people. And there was a lot of communication verbally. People would give messages, oral or written messages, to travelers or ship captains. If someone was needed to get a message from Boston to New York, you would find somebody who was making that trip and ask them to deliver the message for you. So there was not an expectation that unless somebody died and left you property or something of that sort, like I say, most Americans didn't even get one letter per year until the middle of the 19th century.
Well, we're talking to Winifred Gallagher about her book, How the Post Office Created America, A History. You write in the book about the first direct mail campaign began in the 1820s. That's interesting. What was that about?
Yeah, it is interesting. The Sabbatarians, back in that time, evangelical Christians were becoming prominent for the first time in public life, and they took real umbrage at the idea that mail was delivered on Sundays, which it was. Mail could be delivered on any day that the mail was received at the post office, which was pretty much 7 days a week. So they decided that that was a terrible desecration of the Sabbath, and they organized a direct mail campaign to stop that practice ingeniously by stopping the stagecoach deliveries of mail. So by stopping the transportation of the mail, that would in effect close the post office. So made a very, very impressive, they got pretty far along on toward their goal, but they were, and they were called the Sabbatarians, the Sabbath defenders, but they were opposed by an equally vigorous group of anti-Sabbatarians who felt that they had fought very long and hard for postal delivery. They often lived in the South and in rural areas as opposed to the Sabbatarians who were more concentrated in the Northeast. And they said that they didn't want religious interference with their mail service. But it did set a very important precedent for the use of the post office for political reasons, and the big example of that came shortly thereafter in the 1830s when abolitionists sent unsolicited abolition materials, newspapers, to randomly chosen prominent Southern folks, which infuriated people in the South who objected to the U.S. mail being used in this way to incite slave rebellions and all kinds of things that they didn't want to hear about. Slavery was then being promoted in the South as a benign, paternalistic institution that benefited both master and servant, and they were infuriated by this. And a big shipment of this abolitionist mail arrived in the Charleston, South Carolina post office in 1835, and a mob gathered there. The postmaster was traumatized. He called his boss in Washington, who was Amos Kendall, Andrew Jackson's postmaster general, a political appointee, and the postmaster said, "What should I do?" And Kendall kind of temporized and said, "Well, you know, you can't, the native sympathies of the people must be taken into consideration." He didn't just say, "You've got to deliver the mail," which in fact was the case. And shortly, a mob assaulted the post office, took the mail and burned it, which was, of course, a federal crime. But they really, it was like cutting off their nose to spite their face, because the incident, which was a federal crime that also raised the issue of, like, censoring the mail, helped illuminate slavery as a national issue. Until then, it wasn't really a big national issue. There were some abolitionists, but most Americans were somewhere in the middle there. It was primarily a Southern issue. But with the burning of the mail in Charleston, South Carolina, that really helped publicize slavery.
Interesting. So mess with the mail and really pay a price there.
That's right.
Grumpy John of Grants Pass emailed several minutes ago, so not in response to what we're just talking about now, but he says, "So that's why we have so much junk mail. Can we do anything about it? Thanks." Interesting, says Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Junk mail.
Yeah, it's a problem because the post office feels it's in no position to turn down customers, and the mass mailers, the junk mailers, of course, pay to circulate that mail. What's particularly interesting, where you can really see this conflict, in my opinion, for at least 50 years, Americans have said that they don't really care very much about Saturday letter delivery. They can live without it. It costs a lot of money. So why do we still have it? We still have it because a lot of people are invested in the postal status quo. The big mailers want Saturday delivery because that's when they send out a lot of junk mail, because they want the advertising for weekend shoppers. So the weekend is very important for them. The big postal unions want to keep Saturday letter delivery because they want to keep jobs and hours for their membership. So it's very hard to, it's like, you know, the image of turning the oil tanker or the battleship, you can't do a 90-degree turn very, very rapidly. It's a frustrating situation. Nobody likes junk mail, and I think the post office really can't continue to argue for its existence based on junk mail.
But is it possible the post office could take a stronger position against it if it does get some reform through Congress in terms of the 75-year pension obligation?
Yeah, and not just that. The post office really needs to be, it's in need of a radical reform, and that hasn't happened. Congress refuses to do it for the reasons that I just outlined. A lot of people invested in the postal status quo. So getting Congress to take action on this is difficult because those big industries pay for political campaigns, for example. So it's not going to be easy. But right now is actually a hopeful moment, because after a long time, the Senate now has passed a bill. The House very recently has passed a bill, and I think if they could be combined together, we could actually have the Postal Reform Act of 2016, which we desperately need. that would allow the post office to update its business model, update itself for the 21st century, and continue to be our national hard copy delivery system. I think that could happen and should happen.
So a couple of interesting facts that you pull up through the history of the post office. For one thing, I didn't realize there used to be ladies' windows to segregate customers by gender.
Women became important postal customers around the middle of the 19th century. Before that, letter mail was too expensive for women. It was mostly for businessmen. But when cheap postage came into existence, women were writing letters like mad, and so they were going to post offices because people picked up their mail for most of our the time until the Civil War started to change. Post offices had been male spaces. They were public spaces. So now we're in the Victorian era where women, middle class and upper class women, were not supposed to appear in public male spaces. They were very constrained about where they were allowed to go. So one solution to that was to have ladies' windows. So if a woman went to pick up her mail or to buy stamps, she went to a special window where she wouldn't be rubbing elbows with any menfolk.
Interesting, and then also stuff in here about segregation and the Wilson administration and the attempt to resegregate the federal government. But save that for another day. In addition to any discussions about the railway mail service and railway post office, one of my favorite subjects. All kinds of great stuff in the book, How the Post Office Created America. Winifred Gallagher wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Winifred, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care.